Hello and welcome, listeners, to Ion EDI, the anti-racism podcast where we unpack equity, diversity, and inclusion. This podcast is recorded on the unceded traditional territory of the Sequimic people. I am grateful for the opportunity to live, learn, and play on their lands.
Hello, Brett. I'm so happy to be here with you today and share this space. For people listening, we actually met at a climate change conference on adapting and mitigating climate change. And in light of the report in 2021 on the IPCC climate report, I think it really puts climate activism as well into perspective. And I'm really happy to share this space with you. I think if I introduce you, it won't quite do it justice. So would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. It's really great to see you again. I'm going to introduce myself and how I do with in my language. It's something that is really important to us and in part of our identity, but also in acknowledging where we come from and where we, you know, where we're going into the future. So my real name is Hetchumsget. My government name is Brett Hewson. And, you know, just recently they announced that, you know, they would allow Indigenous people to get our traditional names on the, but for me, that's another form of assimilation. They want us to put our names on our Canadian identity. If they would allow my nation to create our own passports, that would be something I would look into. But the reasons I still use Brett Hewson in Canada is because it's a government name that associated with the Canadian IDs that I have to carry. But my real name, I keep to my books that I write and my close friends.
Thanks so much, Brett. And you and I have talked about this before. It's something that I'm really passionate about, is letting, not quite letting, because that becomes a power hierarchy, but being able to express your name and who you are in the way that people want to, and not letting that fall into the colonial hierarchies, because it's a really sore point for me when I see people having to anglicize their names or just change their name altogether, and then having people come up to me and say, well, what's your real name? Or do you have another name that you go by that's easier to say? And I think it's just strange form of alienation combined with dehumanization when you have to make yourself just something as straightforward as your name, make that something acceptable to current power structures.
Yeah, don't definitely, you know, and it kind of plagues everything in it right into daily life too, you know, because you'll have people who speak other languages, who work in the service area, who it can be difficult, you know, both for people who are going to order and the people listening to the order. You know, those are the kind of little day-to-day things that kind of hit and you know, kind of perpetuates these stereotypes that a lot of, you know, I don't want to say Canadians, but I would just say, I guess there's nowhere else to say, but a lot of Canadian people, you know, I hear always when you go to order at a window, it's like, learn to speak English. Or I can understand the frustration, but in the same breath, when I hear people saying that, I find it so odd, because they're the outsiders on our lands, Indigenous people's lands, telling someone to speak a language that's not from here, because they're coming from a place that's bringing language from another place, which they just did. And, you know, we're not talking about far past, like Canada is just a tiny little blip in the history of these lands. Like they're just, they're literally a tiny drop out of a rainfall, you know? So I find it an odd remark when people say things like that, because language has so much to play into identities for everyone. And, you know, it's language is the one thing that people have that remind them of their homelands. And language is the one thing that keeps our identities close at hand. And identity is incredibly important. Being accepted in a community and having the identity of the community you're accepted into is something that is key, and it is a part of humanity and where it is right now. Like everything that people experience in today's world, everything from the types of food that are cooked, the spices that are used to cook those foods, the technologies that are developed, everything in this world did not come from patriarchy and did not come from colonization. Those things came from the minds of people from many different nations across the world and their contributions to overall history of people. So identity and cultures and the perpetual integration of many different cultures is important if we want to keep, you know, the world evolving in this kind of way where we have amazing things to look forward to. You know, like myself, you know, my wife, her dad is from Trinidad, and I truly enjoy the types of food that come from Trinidad. They're uniquely Trinidadian, but the history behind it comes from other places. They, you know, they come from the people who were enslaved and brought to those islands, and they mixed their cultural teachings and their foods together to make this amazing food that I love. I can't imagine not being able to access those foods, all the foods that I, the spices that I enjoy, because my people in the past, we had like different herbs. We didn't have the spice though. And that's the thing that I truly enjoy now out of today's world, you know, like that I would miss if we didn't have it. And those come from other cultures. And so all of these things are uniquely tied into language.
Sorry, I just had a moment of laughter internally because you brought up spice, and it makes me laugh a little that the British Empire colonized half the world and went around half the world for spices and spice trade. But really the only popular spice used is salt and pepper. So that's just a moment of laughter that I always have. You're completely right about the idea that advancement in society now didn't just come from colonial power and colonial advances and people in the Western Hemisphere making these discoveries. I actually have a book that I really love about 1001 inventions that were made in the Middle East. And it is mind-blowing that the basis of this modern science, the classification of elements, algebra, everything that we enjoy in the world today in terms of mainstream advances, those were all just taken after the Crusades. That wasn't Western knowledge per se, or I should say that wasn't European knowledge, you know? Those weren't the advances there. Something as simple as soap, like hard soap, wasn't a Western or European advancement. So that always gives me a moment of pause when I think about the erasure of cultures and the pressure to become anglicized. I think it takes a lot of propaganda and a lot of many years worth of brainwashing to convince people that their heritage and their advancements aren't good enough and they should just all become one with the modern perceived Western culture, in a sense. I'm trying to word that appropriately.
No, definitely. You know, and one of the key examples here, and, you know, with regards to the indigenous communities, indigenous nations of these lands, from contact and from the time that we saw the people developing on the lands that we call home, we saw the degradation of the ecosystems and their need to consume, their need to develop, really harmed the livelihoods of every being that exists on these lands. And the thing that is part of the understandings of the nations is that the whole ecosystem is connected. Everything is interconnected. Even the separated ecosystems that are unique to each territory are connected through climate. They're connected through water systems. They're connected through mycorrhizal fungi that travel between different lands. You know, like there's a lot of different things that we understood as nations. And when colonization started to happen on the territories, you know, you see everything that people looked at North America as being, the way the land looked, the beauty, the structure of the mountains, the prairies, the like the grasslands, everything that was a part of, you know, what people perceive as a Canadiana identity was made and built by indigenous land management practices. It wasn't all 100% just popped up exactly how it was. Everything was born out of the way that we would manage the lands. There are particular ways that we would look at different species, the way that they would migrate. And there were particular ways that we would make sure that we had these different species in particular areas because we saw how they impacted the land. As an example, bison are a keystone species to the grasslands because they actually create the biodiversity in the grasslands. They keep the plants from just going wild. And, you know, their impact on the land, the way they trample it, is actually what creates the biodiversity that takes in the carbon from the carbon sequestration that comes. It's from biodiversity. And one of the things that, you know, Western science has really become aware of is this idea that, you know, they're wondering why there's desertification of a lot of places on Earth. And so they're like, well, it's because there's a lack of water. But then you see places that have had that and have attained water over time, that didn't become more biodiverse. It didn't grow. It didn't explode. And part of the reason is because they didn't have ungulates like bison to trample down the land and push those nutrients into the soil. And when they push those nutrients into the soil, that creates place for biodiversity to flourish because they're creating the fertilizer for the soil. So those types of species, interconnected species, and the way that they're working together is something that's needed and something that we understood. For us, where I'm from, the Kyrgyzstan nation, our whole culture evolved around the life cycle of the salmon. And this is because the salmon are a keystone species for our ecosystem. They literally create the rainforests that are only unique to our parts of the world. And the biodiversity that is in our territory is directly tied to the population and health of the salmon. And as those populations are declining because of commercial fishing, and it's only commercial fishing and development that are depleting the populations. And we saw this in the early 1900s when they started the fisheries. With a decline of population, you're actually seeing a decline in reforestation and biodiversity in all these systems. The cedar trees aren't growing as fast as they used to. The pine trees, they're not growing as large as they used to. So a lot of these systems are starting to deplete. And those types of forests are what help regulate the moisture retention in the land. And now that you're having droughts and lower population of salmon, and we're not doing controlled burns like we used to, that's another thing Indigenous peoples did. We did controlled burns for thousands of years. We did controlled burns. And we prevented wildland fires from, because they naturally happen, we prevented them from spreading across all the lands like they do right now. So it was in the 40s that they prevented, at least us in the West Coast, 1940s when they prevented us from doing controlled burns. And since the 1940s, that fuel has been building up on the forest floor. And there's something like a foot of dry tinder, dry fuel from the generation of forest that was left unburnt. And once that fuel ignites, you can't put it out. You can have torrential rain on certain spots for a week, and it's not going to put it out because it gets so hot that it creates that white ash, and it leaves this layer on top of the soil, which then makes the soil hydrophobic. And then when it rains, the water is just running down, and all the white ash goes into the tributaries, covers all the salmon spawning grounds, and creates like a cement at the bottom of where they usually would spawn. And so all of this stuff is leading to further droughts. And you know, so the mitigation that could be happening if the salmon population was healthy is not happening during our rapidly changing climate. So there's a lot of things that I believe should have been left to us to look after, as us as in the Indigenous nations of the land, because we're from here. We have thousands of years of knowledge and experience. Our sciences are sound. We wouldn't have existed and flourished here for so long without it. And a prime example of that is the first people who came to these lands did not survive. The first people who came to these lands were dying rapidly, and we took pity on them. And instead of helping us and, you know, kind of sharing with us afterwards, they did everything they could to try to get rid of us once we showed them how to live on these lands. And that's one of the things that, you know, are left out of the history books.
You mentioned books, and it actually brings me to your work as an author and as a writer. And I wanted to ask, first of all, do you mind just sharing with our listeners what kind of books you write and how you got into writing in the first place?
Yeah, for sure. So growing up in the way that I did, I was really, you know, I grew up in a pretty traditional way. I spent a lot of my time on the land, spent a lot of time with my grandparents, and I was always asked to share stories. And I always wanted to be a storyteller. And so when I actually first went away to school, I actually started in a geomorphology program. And I saw that that wasn't quite the path that I was going to get me to where I wanted to be. It was just kind of one narrow frame. And at the same time, I was contending with racism in the school system because, you know, part of the program that I was taking, there was a civilizations class. And when they were talking about Indigenous people, it was like inaccurate that was being taught. And I had an argument with the professor, and they basically all but failed me out of the class, even though I was getting high marks on the papers and everything. And it was because I said that she was wrong, that everything that you're teaching is 100% wrong, and I can verify that. And she asked me how I could verify that. And yeah, I said, I am Indigenous. And she's like, well, we're talking about your ancestors. Like, I am part of my ancestors. I said that we never lost this knowledge. Like, you're talking as if we died and came back. I said, we didn't die. we aren't gone. We never left. And, you know, she couldn't handle the facts that I was giving to her. And because it wasn't in a book, you know, that was the standard that she was holding me to. And so I knew that wasn't the place for me. It's not that I don't place value on education. I think if people can get through the system, it's, you know, it's important. Education is definitely important. But for me, that wasn't an institution for me. As an Indigenous man who takes to heart my identity at that time, you know, and we're talking in the early 2000, you know, because I go back.
I would have been so small.
So, you know, back then, it was even worse than it is now. And it wasn't a place for me. And you had a lot of people who get through school. There's a lot of Indigenous academics out there. And, you know, I praise them for their work. But for me, when you have to equate my knowledge to what is written by a non-Indigenous person in a book that has nothing to do with the culture or our knowledge of the land, then it's not for me. Because, you know, I'm not going to give up who I am just to assimilate and be someone else. And so this was something that I kind of took to heart, and I ended up getting into film and television. And how that happened was I met a filmmaker who made a film about one of our people, and he also did a documentary on Doll Sheep, which, you know, I'm like, wow, this guy can talk about history, but he can also talk about science. And I love that. He's like, how did you do that? And he said, oh, I just started making films. And he's about my son. He's going to school in Capilano. So I ended up going to Capilano University for film and television production. So I went there, and then I got into film and television production. I worked with APTN for 11 years. I thought that I might, you know, break into something through there, but it was a great place to gain some experience, but it definitely wasn't the place where I'm going to finish my career. There was no room for me to grow anymore. And so I left. And as soon as I left, I started connecting with storytellers. I was asked to write a story about water and from my community for a youth magazine here called Red Rising Magazine. And so I wrote the story Sockeye Mother, and my publishers read that and asked me if I wanted to turn it into a book. So they got in touch with me and they made me an offer. And I never thought that I'd be writing books. So then I said, well, you know, this is just part of a series. I was going to continue writing in Red Rising. And they said, okay, well, we'll take your series. And then, so they wanted me to have initially 12 books. But I don't want to do that many, because this is only a part of my longer vision. This initial piece was to connect young people to just the rudimentary understanding that everything is interconnected. So as you read throughout the series, you see that there's reoccurring patterns, that every one of these species is connected to the same land, and they contribute to the land in the same way. They contribute to the cultures in the same way. And that you see that this whole world is all one, and that humanity isn't separate or above or anything. The problem that we have with humanity now is that we believe we're above everything. We believe that we should shape the world to meet our needs, but that's not the case. You know, we're basically, you can equate us to being a virus or a cancer in the way that we're living right now. we're trying to change life to meet our needs. Whereas before, we used to just be part of this living ecosystem. You know, that's one of the things that we need to do now. We need to figure out how can we shift this ginormous population of people into this way. So these books are a part of that initial project. It's, for me, it's starting with the young people, because they're important. They're the important ones that we need to share knowledge with. And I'm going to be working on other books that will be tied to the same topics, you know, and it'll get more advanced speaking to each demographic. So that's kind of where my path is going now, is I'm going to finish this series, and then I'm going to work on some books for adults.
You know, it made me quite excited to see children's books. When I was looking up your work, I was really excited because I started school in London, Ontario. For people not familiar with the school system there, you start junior kindergarten at 4. I was there until grade 1 before we moved away. We've done a lot of globe trotting in our family. So before we moved away, and I do not remember any exposure to Indigenous culture at all, like zero, which is a long time to have gone through school with no sort of exposure at all. I remember, I think, a mayor coming in, and that was it. That wasn't even related to Indigenous culture, which made me think that if we can have a mayor or some politician, I can't remember who it was, come in, why can't we have Indigenous people come in and, you know, really help students understand where they're living, what's going on, what the reality of life really is, and the history and everything that went into and everything that was destroyed in creating the system that they live in, especially because I remember kindergarten being already a really racist place. So it doesn't surprise me in recollection for it to have been that way. But actually, why I was really excited further is that the first proper re-exposure, I would say, I had to Indigenous culture, like properly immersed, was when I lived in Dubai, well, a little town nearby, Alain, not that anybody would recognize it. But I went to an international school there that followed the Sabbath system, which is kind of a Middle East Europe-wide school system. And every semester, they would give us a reader book based on the history of a different part of the world. And some of them were really like obscure. There were like that I would never have been exposed to living in Canada, like a queen from the Hausa people in Africa who was my namesake. So she was extra special to me as a little kid. But one of the books that we were given was Crazy Horse, about a person named Crazy Horse who fought against the American government's forcible control over his nation and his lands. And that was the first proper exposure I had. And that was through a story, because the way it was set out was that a grandfather was telling his grandchild the story of Crazy Horse, and then it would flash back. And so I just perceive storytelling as an incredibly intricate way of teaching children about history, science, and everything. And I think that's common across many cultures around the world, that even in, for us personally, we do a lot of moral storytelling. So instead of just telling a child that this is right, this is wrong, you tell them through a story. And one of the ones that really stands out to me, because I'm quite a talkative person often, is, as evidenced by the fact that we've started up a podcast for me to speak on, is that one by Saadi Shirazi, who is a Persian Sufi poet and storyteller, about the value of silence and how somebody who was speaking all the time, or sorry, was silent most of the time, was regarded as really smart and intellectual until he spoke. And then the image shattered. That's something that stuck in my head. And a lot of times when I talk now, I think of it as like, oh, maybe I should stay silent for a minute and then I should speak. So I love the fact that you're able to connect children with Indigenous culture through books and through stories, because it's just, I think it's a really powerful method of learning that's kind of been undervalued by colonialism.
Yeah, you know, and one of the things growing up is I never saw myself in anything. I never saw myself in media. You would see movies like Dances with Wolves or The Last of the Mohicans, and they're all romanticized, Hollywood romanticized versions of Indigenous peoples as they were at the end of our flourishing. We were basically, the way that people envision Indigenous people is already the only way they see it is stuff that was written by the white people at the time. And at this particular moment, we are already ravaged by pandemics. We were already completely debilitated by colonization. So they only see these images of us when we weren't at our best, because we were just surviving. And so, you know, growing up, I didn't care for those things. Like, I mean, I'd watch it in a movie, it was entertaining, but, you know, our people were never the main characters. Like, Last of the Mohicans was about Chingachgook, and it had nothing to do with Chingachgook. It was all about Daniel Day-Lewis and his heroism. But, like, the book was supposed to be about Chingachgook, the old man, because he is the last of the Mohicans in the story. So, you know, everything is always written, so there's a savior in every one of these films.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and that's how it is with books too. Like, the books that were written about us, like, especially in particular with my people, Marius and Barbeau, these anthropologists, highly inaccurate depictions of what our people are. And they didn't understand our ways of life, even though they did talk to some of our knowledge keepers. Again, there's that things being lost in translation. Jesuit priests were the first ones to translate our language, and they didn't understand the meanings of things. When we talked about energy and stuff like that, like, they didn't understand the terms and terminology behind it. And for them, the idea of the universe and the way that exists right now was a myth to them. They mythologized everything that we wrote and talked about. And it's because of the terminology. If you look at Indigenous cultures, the way that we understood the world is based off of our observation, the repeated observation of certain instances that we would speak about. And we praised the universe for keeping us alive and giving us life, because in our opinion, when your energy that lives in that other world, you can't make the same choices that you do when you're given this life. So this life, when we're brought into this life, it was our opportunity to make choices, because you know, you're able to choose the paths you take throughout your life. So that's something that, you know, you can't do as pure energy. Because as pure energy, you exist as part of the universe. So those are the things that kind of came out through our understandings of the world, you know. So when we come to this world, we use things in prayer, because for us, you know, aligning your energy with where you want to go is what we do in this life. And for us, we don't pray to think that we get what we want just by praying. We pray to help ourselves align to where we want to be, and we have to put in as much work as the universe gives to us. So when we pray for something, it's not going to just come. Like if we pray for life, for instance, you say, oh, I really want a better life. Well, yeah, you pray for it, but you're not just going to sit around and get a better life. You have to work, and you work towards that better life. And that prayer helps that energy align to the universe. You know, that's our perspective in our prayers. When we're asking for something, it's not just to all of a sudden get it. It's so that the universe knows what we want, and it puts everything in our way to make decisions to be able to get those things. Again, you make those choices in your life to take those signs that you prayed for, or to just continue going randomly throughout without making decisions. There's a lot of different ways that life works, and it was very complex for us. So the ceremony has a lot to do with that. When we think about Creator, we're not thinking about a personified person standing there making judgment. We're thinking about the universe that exists. And that universe gave us this opportunity. This is everything. The Creator for us is just everything. So those are the different things that come through our understandings of the world and our culture that got lost in translation. You know, even trying to explain it in English is a very difficult thing to do. It's easier for me to understand it in our languages. It's easy for us to understand it, but to try to explain it in English is such a difficult concept, difficult thing to do. But I think when we invite people to experience with us and they choose to participate in our ceremonies, they understand that, you know, we're not there to convert people. We're not there to tell them who they're going to be. We're just there to present to them the world as we know it, and the world as we understand it, and the world that we know that we don't own. We just share with every other being that exists on this, in this life. Those are the things that, you know, the way that I live and the way that I look at the world, those all come from my grandmother. And those are the things that I hope to share with a lot of my work that I'm doing now and into the future.
You know, it strikes me a lot, the danger of the single story narrative, where people only see one side of the community. Going back to how you spoke about movies, I, for one, boycott anything that has any negative perceptions of any community of color, like any visible minority or really global majority, because most people are melanated on the earth anyways. But any movie like that, I personally boycott. I refuse to watch it. And if any of my family members try to, I start ranting to them too. But it reminds me of like the danger of that single story narrative, because I think this is a reality, really, is that when you listen to something firsthand from the source, even me just listening to you speak, it'll be largely different to listening to a translation of it or a recount of it, of perceptions of what you've just said, or the perceptions of someone's story or someone's statement or someone's culture, because it changes the story or it changes the issue from reality to your perception of reality. And I think that was one of the things in colonization globally that really harmed both the communities and prevented people from making connections around the world, because people's perceptions of me is A, that I'm dangerous, or that I am not as capable as someone else. And I'm sure people's perceptions of you are automatically, you know, well, it's a fact, or influenced by the fact that you are indigenous. And for me, it's because I'm melanated and I'm Muslim and I'm dark skinned and all these things, and I'm an immigrant. And I think it prevents people from making connections across the world and making connections across communities. Because when I speak with you, Brett, actually, I feel more at home and I feel more connected to myself and my learnings, because they're so similar. I'm struck with the similarity between the cultures and even just the way we express ourselves in languages, because I think so much stuff gets lost in translation into English because there's just no translation or the feeling doesn't come through. And I think it just really prevents people from making connections with others when you have that dangerous single story narrative in between.
Yeah, no, exactly. You know, and that's one of the things too, with regards to other storytellers from the other nations, you know, they're going to bring a different perspective than mine. And it's important, you know, we share all these different perspectives because, like I said before, from the beginning, cultural identity is incredibly important. Cultural identity is the, you know, they're the things that have literally built the beauty in the world.
Yeah.
Everything that is beautiful comes from cultural identity and understanding of the land. You know, we cannot deny culture. Even when there are radicalists that come out of the cultures, you know, that shouldn't be portrayal of those cultures. You know, like I think about an example of a culture that was incredibly radicalized, but they didn't keep the perception in that, you know, you look at Germany. That wasn't all of Germany, but for that time during the World War, most people believed it was all of Germany. And but following after they created those treaties, after the World Wars ended, people accepted that that wasn't the German identity. But you look at other cultures like myself with our nation, we are perpetually placed under a very distinct stereotype. We are perpetually placed as threats. We're still listed as a terrorist threat under the government's list. If we gather in more than 150, we're considered a terrorist threat.
Wow.
So we regularly have military visiting every single one of our protests.
I've heard of that.
You know, like where I'm from, we had tanks that came up at one point, even when we were roadblocking trains. We didn't have weapons. When the tanks came up, we threw marshmallows at them. And they call that the marshmallow wars. And that was us showing that, you know, we're protecting the land with our bodies because the land is more important than anything that you guys represent. And because it keeps our kids alive. So that's what we fight for, is we fight for the land and the ecosystems. You know, you look at now the Wet'suwet'en, they're our allies. They're our close allies. They, you know, we've had connection and we've had partnership and allyship with the Wet'suwet'en people for thousands of years. Right now, you know, they're going through that. They've had military come up to their protests for trying to stop a pipeline. We've had military. You look at the Oka crisis. They wounded people. They killed people. Like, we're not talking about other places. This is here in the so-called human rights capital of the world, but I don't believe we are. You know, people haven't seen the worst of it because we're past the worst part. We survived. Indigenous people survived the worst. There used to be millions and millions of us across this whole continent. They couldn't get rid of us. So now they're trying to deal with us in a different way. Hitler praised Canada and the US for how they deal with us. And that's actually what he based his camps off of. All of the camps were based off of the way that the reservation system works here. And if you read his diaries, he actually praises John A. MacDonald and I think it was President Johnson. I can't remember who it was. I don't really know their names, but MacDonald, who's always praised here, was a hero to Hitler. And, you know, those are the things that you don't hear from being taught in the schools, but they should be. It's the people that are praised in this country and are held up high are the ones who tried wiping us out. You know, like even Nellie McClung, who's the woman who got the first vote in Canada. She's got a statue here in Winnipeg. She is one of the biggest proponents of eugenics, sterilizing Indigenous women. She fought for that. She actually made that a bill in Alberta, and I think she tried getting it national. And you know that still happens, as you found out in Saskatchewan, like, what, 4 or 5 years ago, they were caught sterilizing Indigenous women. So it happens now. It's not a past thing. It's happening now. The child welfare system, it's another system. You know, we only make up something like 2% of Canada's population, but we make up something around 47% of the child welfare system. And it has nothing to do with quality of care they're receiving from their parents. A lot of times kids are taken because their community doesn't have clean drinking water. So the government immediately is like, okay, let's go take them out of there.
How about we provide that clean drinking water first?
Exactly. you know, I have family who come from places where their, you know, homes aren't, they're full of mold. They don't have any running water, and you know, they're full of rats, and they're kind of infested. Like, I have family that live in those places. These are the things that, you know, I'm not tied to any political party, because I just don't believe in any of Canada's governments.
But, I don't either.
One person that I do admire lately is Jagmeet for everything that he's been standing up for. The way that he speaks about the inequalities of our people. People say, well, where's his action behind it? He's actually been doing a lot of stuff, like as much as he can in the position he's in. Like even now, traveling to different communities to try to figure out how they can get clean drinking water there if the government's not going to do it. Like, that's crazy. The fact that a party that's not in power is trying to find a way to get money to do it themselves if they can't have the government do it. Like, and that's happening right now. You know, he just finished traveling to the communities. You know, the stuff that the federal NDP is doing, they continue to do after the election happened. They didn't just say they were doing it during the election. They continued after, and their work continues now. That's what I wish we could, at least that. But the, you know, this is exactly like you said, if any of these things happened to a municipality that was an Indigenous community, and it's already been like that, they fixed it immediately. The infrastructure funds were put in place immediately. The disaster control was put in, disaster relief was put in place immediately. You know, why is it not the same for us? You know, these are just a lot of the different things that play into our place in this government. I don't want to say country, because this land is where we are from. There is nowhere else that we're from. The people who always tell other people to go back to where they came from aren't from here. They're the ones who came in and imposed these things. And their government, I always say their government, it's not my government. I'm just forced to live in here, live with it. You know, like I'm not particularly tied to Canada as an identity. I only have to if I got to travel. When people ask me my nationality, I always say Gitxsan. The only times I write Canadian is if I have to when I'm traveling, or if I have to for funds, applying for funds for something. So, you know, there's just a lot of different things that plague our ability to be ourselves.
I had a minute of just listening too deeply, and it kind of took my brain off into the, I don't know, sometimes when I listen very deeply to things, I get very into it, and then my ability to form thoughts runs away from me. I've actually been thinking a lot about kind of the resurgence and a little bit of a performative allyship aspect to how people engage with Indigenous communities. And one thing that really scares me sometimes is failing in my allyship, to be completely honest, because I never want to be the cause of further harm. And any partnership or any effort to help out that I do is coming from a sense of understanding, because of course I come from a place that was also colonized. And I say to this to my family, if we were not in such a huge population, we'd all be wiped out too. It was just the fact that it was very densely populated that they weren't able to get rid of the local populations. But anyways, because it comes from like a sense of understanding. And I know that in my communities, there's a denial of colonization per se. Like there's this sense of that, oh no, but the British were great. They built us hospitals. And my thing is, well, there were hospitals before, guys. It's okay. There was stuff before too. It comes from a deep sense of understanding, empathy kind of way. I'm not able to verbalize it, to be completely honest, but I just have this fear of failing in my allyship, like overstepping or not performing as well as I can. Of course, this is a big question to ask. Like, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but what recommendations do you have for people who really do want to lend extra bodies, lend extra hands, extra minds? I think there's power in numbers. And when people join causes, I think it makes a bigger difference. And so kind of that's what I'm getting at. Like, how do I help out?
Well, I think one of the greatest things that allies can do is to try to change the system. It's not our system. We've been working every angle that we can to change the system so we fit better into this world. And it's just not ours. So I think the people who believe in the Canadian government, who believe that it represents them, and our allies, I think they need to work really hard to try to change it, because we are trying and we're just constantly ignored and thrown to the side by the government. They will invest so-called millions or sometimes billions, but when you actually break down how many years that passes over and where the funds actually come from after they've cut things, they're not actually expending anything. They're trying to blind people with these so-called gestures. They're horrible gestures that are done at the wrong time. And this is the truth that every survivor speaks, the truth that my dad shared with me, the truth that my family told me, and I listened to their hurts and their pains, and I lived with the dysfunction that came from it, that come from this government. And we need to change it. And the simple fact of the matter is the country itself is full of people that are no longer represented by this government the way that it is. It needs to be reformed. In fact, I don't think there should be parties, period. There should just be an election for someone who can speak for the country outside of the country, but every sort of region should be able to govern themselves and work to disperse the types of funds and things that come from the government itself. The head of the government should not be the decision-making person. There's no such thing as a decision-making person. They should just be the face of the decision makers, who are the people. I mean, that's the big goal, but the reason I'm saying that is because that can only happen when people that are not Indigenous take the time to educate one another and to share the things. Because, you know, it's exhausting. Honestly, it is truly exhausting. And you'll know this in some capacity through trying to address people's questions about your culture. And we can't ever waver in how we present ourselves. We can't get frustrated because as soon as we make one little faulty move, the world will drop down on us and criticize us and make us villains for acting out in one small moment of frustration. But it is honestly exhausting to constantly be educating. And, you know, the thing is not all the people from my nation have the ability to speak the way that I speak and to hold a conversation in confidence the way that I can hold it in confidence to people that they might see as higher up than them, because our people have been oppressed. So I believe that I have this ability, I have this gift to be able to share our stories, that I have to take this responsibility to share and to tell these stories. It is exhausting, but, you know, I think we need more allies to step up to start telling these stories to others. I think there's definitely room for people who are coming from other places that have experienced the same kind of hurts. And in some instances, they're just going through the hardest parts now that, you know, we've already lived through. They're just going through those now, the militarization and death of a lot of their own people. Like, you know, the RCMP, when they started, that was their job in Canada. They were literally created to control the Indian problem, as they called it. Other countries are just facing those things now, you know, but I still think there's room. When they come here, they know what's happening or know what has happened. And, you know, allyship just comes into education. You know, we don't need anyone to give up their jobs and just jump full on and, you know, go hardcore into changing the world right now. But every little bit of education helps. Every little bit of the way when you're thinking about voting, you know, look at the people who speak the loudest about Indigenous issues. And I think we need more women in leadership roles. And that's another thing too, when it comes to change. Men are full of pride. Men don't make the best decisions because of their pride. Men do not have enough empathy for the world. You know, yes, I'm going to generalize that because there's proof of that. There's hundreds of years here of proof of that. There's thousands of years of evidence from my nation that women keep us alive. There's thousands of years of evidence from my nation that we flourished with the matriarchs who led us. But there is no evidence that men leading the people led to anything fruitful in my nation. So for me, I want to see more women in leadership roles. And you look at how amazing New Zealand is doing as a post, yes. I don't know what you would call it, the modern government, I guess you could say. Yeah. In the modern governments, in the modern British style system, New Zealand is freaking blowing up. You know, like, they're doing so well. They're not perfect, but they're doing so well compared to every other place. They've been through the pandemic in such a great way. And who do they have in leadership roles? It's a lot of women.
Jacinda. You know?
Yeah. And that's because they set up amazing support systems. They know that when you're in that leadership role, you don't make all the decisions. You just are the face of all your decision makers who help you make the right choices. that's how our governance systems used to work. And well, they still do. For my people, they still do. Where everything goes through the mother. My real name, my clan, my privileges on our territory all come from my mom. And, you know, that's probably the only thing that has kept our nation alive culturally. All the greatest leaders we have in my nation, they're all women, the ones who hold up the culture. And right now, not saying that all the men that are chiefs in my nation are bad. We have a few good ones, but there's a lot who have signed away our land for a few bucks. Like, you know, they'll get money in the bank from a pipeline company just to sign over permission to do whatever they want to the territory. No, that's just wrong, because, you know, they don't care about their grandkids. Money's not going to solve any of their grandkids' problems. Money is important for sure to have a quality of life that in this country that people want, but it's not going to make you overall happy. So there's got to be that balance, right? There's got to be a balance. And I think when you have more women in leadership roles, there's more empathy to create balance. That's one of the biggest things for me, the teachings that I receive.
Thank you so much, Brett, for taking time to speak with us today. I know it can be, at least for me, it is exhausting to constantly have to come and speak on anti-racism or colonialism. I find myself to be exhausted. So I do appreciate the fact that you took some time out of your day to speak with us. And I always, whenever we speak, I always go away thinking more than I did when I come in. And I think there is incredible value to a conversation that makes me think. And I really appreciate you coming on. And so thank you so much.
I truly appreciate the opportunity. And, you know, I enjoy being able to share with other people who know the experiences and know the, you know, who live their cultures and enjoy other ways of living. You know, it's important to me to share. And, you know, I hope to one time learn more about your way of life and your culture as well. But thank you for the opportunity to share mine. I truly do appreciate it.
You can find more information about this podcast, past episodes, and mental health supports on the website on-edi.tribox.ca.